Today on Family Talk.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to another edition of Dr. James Dobson's Family Talk. I'm Ryan Dobson, and today we're going to continue our conversation with former Senator of South Carolina, Jim DeMint. Yesterday, my dad spoke with Senator DeMint about how we can fall in love with America again. And at the end of yesterday's program, they were talking about how big is not always better, especially when it applies to the federal government. But before we jump back into the program, I want to remind our listeners that Jim DeMint is a former senator and congressman from South Carolina. He's now the president of a well-known conservative think tank called the Heritage Foundation, and is also the author of several books, including the topic of today's program, Falling in Love with America Again. So here now is Senator Jim DeMint and my dad, Dr. James Dobson, for this edition of Family Talk.
Senator, I thoroughly enjoyed talking to you yesterday. And again, I am enamored with this book, Falling in Love with America Again.
The way I look at it, Dr. Dobson, is I think God has given this beautiful garden that we call America. We're stewards of that garden, and we don't really have the option to leave the governance or the caretaking of that garden to somebody else. It's our job, we the people, and that's what I'm encouraging people to do.
Hmm. Well, at the end of the program last time, we talked about the concept of the big or the bigs. I think in the NBA they call it the bigs. These are the really tall guys that stand under the basket. You're talking about the institutions of this nation that have become too big to love. What do you mean by that?
In the book, we use some data about what institutions American people actually trust. And on the political side, of whether it be the presidency or the Congress, I mean, it's well below 50% of the people trust it. But what people do trust are the smaller institutions of churches and small businesses, local police forces, and even little platoons, part of a larger military. People trust these institutions for a number of reasons. Generally, they know them. They're closer to them. They know the people. But these institutions also have to serve and provide value in order to exist. A lot of the larger institutions, particularly the government and those that are propped up by the government, no longer have to really provide a service that we like in order to continue to exist. And if you've tried to call your cable company or your cell phone company and work with someone over the phone, you know exactly what I mean.
On page 35 of your book, this jumped out at me. Yeah, you said of 16 institutions asked about in the poll, only three enjoyed the confidence of a majority of Americans: the military, small business, the police, and a fourth, organized religion, that had the confidence of 48%. Let me share the statistics from a Gallup poll. This was 2013. That you have charted here. Confidence, having a great deal of confidence or quite a lot of confidence in the institution. The presidency was 36%. The medical system was 35%. And I would guess that's dropping rapidly, not because of the medical people involved, but because of the interference of the government through Obamacare. The U.S. Supreme Court, 34%. The public schools, 32%. The criminal justice system, 28%. Banks, 26%. Television news, 23%. I would have been down around 3% on that one. Newspapers, 23%. Big business, 22%. Organized labor, 20%. HMOs, health maintenance organizations, 19%. And last on this list is the U.S. Congress with 10%. You've been there. You said on the next page that you're only surprised that the Congress managed to get 10% of the country that has confidence.
That must have been K Street lobbyist or something. I don't think I've ever talked to anyone who did. But, I mean, we laugh, but we really can't have a government that's trusted by only 10% of the people. And even the justice system, when you get down to 20 or so percent of people who don't think they can get justice— the problem is a lot is just too big. It's trying to do too much. And when things get big, they get wasteful, they corrupt. Power always corrupts. And we keep throwing more and more things at Washington. And what concerns me is people continue to vote for those who make these false promises that somehow we're going to help the middle class by raising minimum wage. They know that's not true. That doesn't help the little guy. It hurts the little guy. So if we can just get Americans to wake up, forget the political parties, vote for themselves, vote for those things that work, we can show people what works. And we're just showing here that they don't trust the bigs. And there's a reason that 7 out of 10 of the richest counties in America are in Washington, D.C. And they don't produce anything up here that most of us want. But it's because big concentrates wealth in the bigs. And when the doors close and the legislation's written here, for instance, for Obamacare, it's not for the little guy to get health insurance. It's for the big insurance companies who are salivating over forcing every American to buy their product. And it just doesn't work like Americans hope it does. And we need to move power and money decision-making out of Washington and get states to compete. And when they do, we're all better off.
You wrote that Washington is the mother of bigs. And you said on page 11, special interest groups across the political spectrum are spending hundreds of millions of dollars on political campaigns hoping to win a 51% majority so they can gain control of the federal structure and force their ideas and policies on the other 49%. People can see why I like this book and the things that you've said. That's exactly what's happened, isn't it?
It is. And the point I'm trying to make in this book is, while I know that there's certain values and moralities that are going to make life better for people, the way America works is that we can be very diverse. We can live next to each other when people disagree on a lot of things. But if the government starts coercing people to believe in something or to participate in something that violates their conscience, their religious faith, that's when you get a rebellious and resentful nation that's very divided. And I think if we can respect those differences, we can live together as a very diverse country, but not if Washington is trying to force everyone to follow the same idea.
Well, I wish, it's my prayer, that the American people would rise up and say to big government and the rest of the power brokers, get off my back. Turn loose this great engine of prosperity known as democracy. Let it go and see what would happen. That's how we became the most prosperous and successful country on earth. And what has happened here in the United States is absolutely remarkable. How we came from this little fledgling country to the most powerful nation on earth. And it was because the people were free. And freedom is not the natural state of governments. It is, you know, the influence of power brokers. Talk again about who the other bigs are.
But you make a really good point is that if we could just let this go, but the left has been telling the poor, the middle class for years that if the federal government doesn't do it, there'll be no safety nets, that you're on your own and the bigs will take advantage of you. A lot of what I have in this book is evidence to the contrary, that there's always a safety net coming up from the ground that works so much better for this. And we do want a safety net in our country, but the federal government cannot be that safety net. The challenge we have is to convince people that they're most secure when they're most free. Even if they're poor, even if they're unskilled, that the examples I have in this book is the things that are working and actually helping the poor are not coming from Washington. Washington traps people in dependency. It traps them in broken families. And we've got all the evidence in the world to say, forget the politics, folks. If you want Washington to do it, it's going to hurt the little guy. If you want Washington to do it, then wealth is going to concentrate on Wall Street and big unions and big corporations who are up here writing the legislation and the regulations. And the relationships I describe in the book here, if you've got the regulators who one day want to work for the lobbyists, so they're giving them a pass on things, and you've got big corporations carving out something in regulations or legislation that gives them an advantage so they don't have to serve their customers the same way the little guy does. But I'm convinced that this country, it can be greater than it's ever been, and it would not take long to rebuild it if we just move these ideas out of Washington. I think it's starting to happen with education, with the choices that are blooming in every state, and now states are competing for the best system. But if we can elect people who will say, get off our backs, let America work, America will be better than it's ever been.
This may offend you, but I think not. There are times when it looks to me like both Democrats and Republicans are more interested in staying in power than they are in doing what's best for the country. Is that just the perception of a person who's never been there, or is there validity to that idea?
No, that's the perception of a very perceptive person. You've worked with a lot of politician, and it's true. And it seems to, that's why I believe in term limits. It's almost inevitable. There are very few people that are here over 10 years that are really still fighting for something, because this becomes your life, your sound chamber. Everything you hear is coming from inside the Beltway in Washington. But that's what people do. They do things and they justify in their own minds that this is for their constituents, when in fact it's to protect their own power base. And that's why things like earmarks are so attractive. It makes you look good back home. You take back all this money, and it's hurting the country. So anyway, I could preach about term limits a long time, and I hope someday that more and more states will do it, and eventually the federal government will do it.
Expecting them to limit their own power, though, that seems like a long shot to me.
It is. It is a long shot, unless states do it first. If you get 15, 20 states with term limits on their legislatures, then you'll get people elected up here who want to do that, I think.
Yeah, we need to lock them in or they'll change their minds at the last minute. Yeah, I have just written about the moral decline, which is the issue that, as I said yesterday, bothers me the most. And I listed 8 examples of this moral slide. It almost feels like we're going into the sewer. That's a gross term, but it feels that way to me. And then I came after these 8 examples of what's taking place. I wrote this. I don't usually read on the air, but maybe it's appropriate here. I said, these are just a few of hundreds of news stories that caught my attention in recent months. Every day brings additional outrageous developments. They have become so commonplace that many decent people now suffer from what I call protest fatigue. They're worn out by constant battles that they usually lose. Americans have been desensitized by what's happening to our culture. Nothing shocks us anymore, and our nation is indeed losing ground morally. And then this paragraph. The question is, what do we do about it? Would a more conservative political party be able to turn the country around? Probably not, although I would support one as a private individual. Could a man or woman of character set us on the right path? Possibly, but the change would be superficial and temporary unless the people rise up to demand it. My father always said, democracy is the worst form of government if the citizens want evil, because there'll be no stopping them. That's kind of the way I feel about it. Comment on that.
Well, you said the right thing. Actually, it's all in the hands of the people. The thing that encourages me, Dr. Dobson, is trying to remember the scripture that reminds us that we're salt and light. And, you know, salt and light are not big. One little candle in a dark room can shed a lot of light, and one little grain of salt can change the flavor of a piece of food. And so we have to remember that God's never done this with large numbers. Whether you think of Gideon or whoever, he's shown that he can take a few pieces of bread or a few fish and multiply it. But it has to start with us. And what we have to do is just, certainly we have to try to keep holding Washington accountable. And believe me, I do that every day up here. But we've got to have almost a revival among the people, not only in a spiritual sense, but in a sense that I won't be intimidated, that I'm going to stand up for what I believe in, not because I want to push my ideas down the throat of someone else, but that I want to be free. to believe and live the way I think that God's leading me to lead. And if we can get the people, we don't need a majority. I'm convinced if we could get 20, 30% of the people who want to make a change, it would change in a hurry, because you've got the broad middle that are going to follow the people with courage and inspiration. That's what we need right now is people, pastors, business people. It's not going to come from big corporations. Big corporations are pushing the wrong way. It's going to be small businesses, churches, individuals, and small platoons at the local level of all kinds. But we don't need many, because I try to show in the book that in communities all over this country, if you just have a few people who are trying to do something to help the drug addicted, to help the unwed moms, that they can make a huge difference. So let's don't give up and remember the salt and light idea that we just have to be a light where we are. And I have a feeling it will get brighter and brighter if the people will decide to take their country back.
Well, everything has a spiritual dimension, and what you just said comes right out of Scripture. Describe what you mean by federalism. I know that many of our listeners will know the answer to that, but you speak very highly of it. Explain what it is and why it's so important.
Well, it's actually a word that a lot of people don't understand, because it sounds like you want more federal government, and when in fact it's the opposite. It's the original idea of the Constitution that the federal government would have a limited role, primarily in defense and making sure that there is justice throughout the land. The rest, for the most part, was left to the states and to the people. And federalism is 50 states competing for the best education system, the best healthcare system, the best energy development system, the best way to protect families, protecting marriage, ideas like that. And that's what we need to encourage, is we're all better off if the states on all sides of us are trying to do something better, with whether it be lower taxes or just more freedom in protecting people of faith. So federalism is moving power and decisions and money back to the states where it belongs. Not that states are going to do it perfectly, but we're finding if states have to compete, that they get better and better, when in fact the federal government doesn't have to compete, and it seems to get worse and worse and more wasteful and spending more. And actually now it's beginning to drive our morality, our culture into the ground. The states can change that, and that's what federalism is.
It feels to me like that the states are fighting for their place in the sun. I mean, that Washington has come in and told them what they can do, and their laws are not respected. I have many friends in Texas who are pro-life, and to have the justice system, the Supreme Court, force that moral issue down their throats is deeply resented. I mean, there you know this, but there are a lot of people in Texas who would like to secede, would like to be a separate country because they're so irritated by the lack of federalism. And that is the goal of government, is to consolidate power, isn't it? It's not to give power to 50 individual states.
You're right. There are folks that just want to make us like every other country in the world, forgetting that what made America so exceptional and prosperous and compassionate was this concept of ground-up federalism. And we've got states. You know, I've worked some with Rick Perry, and we're trying to organize governors and legislators around the country who are helping to push back against the federal government to take back more control. Unfortunately, the federal government's been handing out money like candy and say, okay, you take Common Core, we'll give you all this money. But I'm proud of a lot of states like Governor Mike Pence in Indiana. He looked at it. He studied it. And he said, this is not for us. So he's going to turn down the money and the program, and they can do things better in Indiana than they can do it at the education department here. And I want to be a part of helping pull these states together and get leaders at the state level to push back, because that's where the courage is. That's where the innovation is. The less we can do in Washington, the better off we are as a nation.
You mentioned Common Core yesterday and today. A lot of people don't know what that is. Explain it. You're against it. I'm against it, too. Explain why.
Well, a lot of people don't know what it is because it was really a very subversive move by the education department and moving it out to states. I've been in states that the legislature didn't pass anything. Their board of education might have accepted it. It was an idea that sounded good as far as it being voluntary and money would come with it. But like every federal program, once you get past the first page and they start writing the regulations, you realize the curriculum they're putting together for this would be a national curriculum. And a lot of moms who've seen the homework that comes home, the questions that are being asked, it's completely ridiculous. And so now more and more
people— Can you give us an example of that?
Well, I'll give you one example. I saw an actual question of a fifth grader. It said, okay, what's 9 plus 16? I think those are the numbers. It could be different numbers. And discuss your answer. And this fifth grader, just you could see, he scribbled down 9 plus 16 is 25. But in the answer, he said, I asked my brain, and I agreed with the answer my brain had. I mean, it's like he had to explain something that was very obvious, that math is about numbers and doing calculations. But where this came from is you had a governor who was successful at setting standards, or several of them did, and they think, oh, it'd be nice to set those same standards for the whole nation. That doesn't work. What you need is states competing for a better and better system, not some standard that basically dumbs down everything over a period of time. But we don't need a common set of standards for the whole nation, other than justice and equality and making sure that every child has a chance. But what we need is a lot of different choices of school that match the different learning styles and interests and aptitudes of students so that everyone can succeed, but they're not going to all succeed at the same thing.
And the goal is to please parents. Those kids don't belong to the federal government or to the nation. They belong to individual families. And we really need to listen to what they feel is best for their kids.
You're exactly right. Unfortunately, and it's almost astounding, there are people in Washington actually challenging the notion that children belong to parents. So if folks think redefining marriage is the last step in this thing, they're going to redefine every institution if we allow them to do it. And it's complete nonsense, because if you want a better life for children, the best place to put them is in a home with a mom and dad. That's not always going to work out, as in my own case, but mom and dad making decisions about schools gets them more involved in those schools, and the children are certainly more active in their studies. And we need to follow the course of what's working. But the resistance is not coming from people who want the best for students. The resistance is coming from the big teachers' unions, whose biggest fear is 50 states doing their own thing. Mm-hmm. They're going to fight it to the end, and they've got their allies in Congress. They're going to fight it, and basically they control a lot of the political spectrum in the country today. We have to push back, but we've got the majority of parents now who want better choices for their children.
The title of the book is Falling in Love with America Again. And the answer to that statement there, falling in love, how do you do that? That is my last question to you. Can we change the course that we're on and save our country?
We not only can, people are doing it all over the country today. We just need to get the federal government out of the way and let America bloom again. It's happening all over the country, and what made us great is still working today.
Well, it's a pleasure talking to you. We've been talking to Senator Jim DeMint, who's just written this book that I hope will be a runaway bestseller, if it isn't already, Falling in Love with America Again. I want to fall in love with my country again. I'm tired of being angry, upset, disillusioned, discouraged about the things that are taking place. And it is possible to turn it around. It'll probably have to be done at the ballot box, because it's not going to happen in Washington, D.C., which the senator calls the mother of bigs. And that's not a good term. Thank you, Senator. I appreciate it. I loved your book. And you and I have been friends a long time. Let's stay in touch.
Thank you so much, Dr. Dobson.
Well,
But what a great way to build up to the 4th of July here on Dr. James Dobson's Family Talk. Coming up next time on Family Talk, we'll continue our build up to the 4th of July weekend with a powerful message by Governor of Louisiana and hero to me, Bobby Jindal, on what makes America great. This is Ryan Dobson saying God bless, happy 4th of July, thanks for listening today, pray for our nation, and we'll see you again next time for another edition of Dr. James Dobson's Family Talk.
Family Talk is not associated with Focus on the Family.
Hello, everyone. This is Dr. Meg Meeker for Family Talk, and I want to let you know about a very special offer that we have handpicked for you for the month of July. For every donation we receive this month, we will send you not only Dr. James Dobson's book, The New Strong-Willed Child, but also the corresponding DVD from the brand new Building a Family Legacy series. Both are yours when you give today by calling us at 877-732-6825 or by visiting our website, drjamesdobson.org. Thank you for supporting us and for standing on behalf of families. And as always, thank you for listening to Family Talk.